From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Ari Snyder with the news on This Day in Maine, Friday, November 14th, 2025. Maine Family Planning is launching a $6.5 million fundraising campaign to ensure access to reproductive health care after it lost federal funding. The organization is prohibited from receiving Medicaid reimbursements under legislation passed this summer, and its federal Title X funding, which supports care for low-income patients, was withheld for months. President and CEO George Hill says those funding sources represent 40% of its budget, or $4 million.
The risk of relying exclusively on one or two different public funding sources is just not realistic in this environment.
Hill says most of the money raised will go toward a $20 million endowment intended to generate enough income to mitigate future funding losses. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development has unveiled a new policy dealing with homelessness. As Nicole Ogrisco reports, the changes may force hundreds of vulnerable Mainers into homelessness or into a shelter system that's already stretched to capacity.
Under the new policy, federal funds will be shifted away from long-term permanent housing and instead toward transitional housing programs with some work requirements. Funding for permanent supportive housing programs will be capped. State officials say they're still working out the exact implications of the new policy, but in Maine, officials estimate that the changes could threaten more than 700 people who risk losing their housing and potentially becoming homeless when current funding runs out. Maine Continuum of Care Director Dean Klein says permanent supportive housing programs have been an effective model in the state.
So for chronically homeless, the elderly, and the youth, this model is critical to stabilizing them and providing opportunities for them to be stable in our community rather than being unsheltered and really being at risk for dying.
HUD officials said in a statement that the policy changes will stop the, quote, Biden-era slush fund that fueled the homelessness crisis and incentivized never-ending government dependency. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Nicole Ogrisco.
A New York man climbed on top of and then fell off a moving bus on the Maine Turnpike near Kittery around 11 a.m. today, according to authorities. 35-year-old Derek McDuffie suffered injuries that were considered serious but not life-threatening and was transferred to Portsmouth Regional Hospital. According to witnesses, McDuffie said he was feeling overheated and opened the bus's emergency hatch before climbing onto the roof while the bus was still in motion. The driver began slowing the Concord Coach Line's bus and attempted to pull over when McDuffie fell from the roof to the roadway, landing on the shoulder of the turnpike. The incident briefly slowed traffic in the area. And now I'm joined by Maine Public's chief politics correspondent, Steve Missler. He's here to talk about the backlash against the Democrats who joined Republicans to end the federal government shutdown. Steve, the shutdown lasted 43 days. It was the longest in U.S. history. And this funding stalemate was in part about Democrats trying to extend subsidies for health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. The expiration of these subsidies affects more than 20 million Americans and about 54,000 Mainers. Does this deal do anything to help them?
Not in the near term and possibly never, Ari. What this deal includes is basically a handshake agreement between the Democrats who voted to end the shutdown and the Republicans who control the Senate to vote on extending the subsidies sometime in mid-December. But, you know, whether that vote even results in passing, that's not a guarantee.
And does the deal say anything about a vote in the House, which would, of course, also be required to pass an extension into law?
It does not. And House Speaker Mike Johnson has been dodgy when asked if such a vote will even take place.
And so this is why Democrats who were against the deal are angry, right? Because it doesn't actually guarantee that they're going to get a vote.
Precisely. But there's a little more going on here that might explain all of the uproar. And it has to do with this current of anger running through the Democratic electorate. We've talked about this before and how it's given rise to candidates like Graham Plattner, the U.S. Senate candidate, running on economic populism and against the Democratic establishment. Plattner was among those who thought Democrats in the Senate should hold out for a guarantee that these subsidies would be extended.
For the past several weeks, Democrats have been fighting back against Trump and fighting for health care. For the first time in a long time, Democrats in D.C. fought back and have held the line. But that all changed last night when several Democrats folded. Instead of holding the line, several Democrats teamed up with Republicans and cut a deal that, to be blunt, will hurt the working people of Maine. This deal is a disaster, and we're going to have real-life consequences to it.
That was Plattner speaking after the deal between Republicans and democratically aligned senators. But Steve, he wasn't the only one blasting this agreement, right?
No, Ari, he was one of many blasting the agreement. It was actually difficult to find Democrats, either congressional Democrats or even gubernatorial candidates, that were happy with this. Governor Janet Mills, who along with Plattner is running for the chance to take on Republican Senator Susan Collins next year, was also pretty forceful during an interview with MSNBC.
First of all, the Congress does not seem to have a backbone. They can't seem to stand up to Donald Trump. We certainly thought that after last Tuesday's elections that people would learn to stand up and say, hey, things aren't going well for the president, for the Congress, for the Republicans in leadership who control the House, control the Senate, and control the White House. They can't figure this out.
And what's interesting about Mills's response is that she was initially skeptical of using the government funding stalemate to extend the ACA subsidies. When I spoke to her about it in September, that was before the shutdown and before she became a candidate for the U.S. Senate. And what that illustrates, I think, is how hardball tactics and strategy are becoming more mainstream views in the Democratic Party. So is criticizing fellow Democrats, which, of course, we saw in abundance after the Senate vote to ratify this shutdown deal.
Right. And in the Pulse newsletter this week, you wrote this is one of the clearest examples yet that Democrats are experiencing a Tea Party-like movement. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, I do think there are a number of parallels to that movement that really shook up the Republican Party beginning in 2010. Back then, there was a lot of pressure on Republicans to take rigid positions, and those that didn't were openly criticized and in some cases faced primary challengers by more ideologically pure candidates. And the animating force there was anger. And that was anger among the Republican electorate, which viewed its leaders as compromised, career politicians, you name it. And this feels a lot like that.
And this backlash that we saw this week against the Democrats who voted for the deal was also pretty intense, and a fair amount of it was directed at Senator Angus King of Maine.
That's right. Of course, King is an independent, but he caucuses with Democrats, and he was among the eight in that caucus who agreed to this deal. And he's really been hearing about it from constituents. He told us this week that he's never seen anything like it. And what's interesting is that King is largely viewed as a pragmatist and often highly regarded for that, but not in this moment.
But King's vote didn't necessarily come as a surprise, right? He was pretty consistent in opposing Democrats taking this tack all along. He voted several times to reopen the government shutdown before this most recent vote. So what's his logic here?
Yeah, he's just held the view that a government shutdown would do more to empower President Donald Trump, all while inflicting a lot of pain on Americans. He told us that he understands the desire to take on Trump and the GOP-controlled Congress.
But the question is, was this the right fight? Is a shutdown, which actually empowers the president rather than disables him and is hurting a lot of people that we want to help, is that the right place to draw the line? And that's what's hard about this. And I get it. People want some place to stand up, and they felt this was it. But it's backfiring in the sense of hurting a lot of people without getting what we want.
And Steve, this shutdown vote divided Maine's congressional delegation. Senator King voted for it. So did Senator Susan Collins and Congressman Jared Golden, but not Congresswoman Shelley Pingree. She, on the other hand, was opposed and also very critical of the deal.
Yeah, she was. And when we talked to her this week, she emphasized how the loss of these ACA subsidies is really going to hurt people. But she also touched on this Tea Party-like dynamic that we've been talking about and how it's important that Democrats fight Trump, fight Republicans. But
I think that we can't get stuck in the trap of Democrats just spending all of our time fighting with each other.
And then she went on to say that it's going to take all kinds of Democrats with different views and backgrounds if they're going to claw their way back into power in Washington. To me, that sounded like a warning of sorts against the ideological purity tests that we saw during the Tea Party rebellion in the GOP. That movement, Ari, prompted some centrist Republicans to leave the party, including Senator Olympia Snowe in 2012, and her departure is how Senator Angus King ended up in that seat.
And that was Maine Public's chief political correspondent, Steve Missler. For more about this, check out our Pulse newsletter. Find it online at mainepublic.org/pulse. Since taking power earlier this year, President Trump has made good on campaign threats to halt American offshore wind projects. His anti-wind agenda has stifled clean energy growth in Maine and the rest of New England, where ocean wind is seen as crucial for meeting long-term electricity demands, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and boosting economic development. Instead, attention is turning up the coast to the Canadian province of Nova Scotia, where a plan to unleash the province's huge wind power resources is gaining speed. Peter McGuire reports.
In a promotional video released this fall, Nova Scotia Premier Tim Houston lays out an ambitious plan for his province.
What if Nova Scotia could power up to 27% of Canada's electricity needs? Stop and think about that. That would make Nova Scotia an energy superpower.
The plan is called Wind West. It would connect up to 60 gigawatts of offshore wind generation to inland population centers. Houston calls the opportunity a golden ticket.
Industry is desperate for clean, reliable energy. Wind West could fuel battery plants, AI data centers, industries of the future. And it would transform our economy here in Nova Scotia.
And the destination for all that potential power?
This energy is very valuable. New England has massive extra energy needs, and they're certainly not alone.
Nova Scotia's proposal has been in the works for years, but it is gaining more relevance as the Trump administration upends New England's offshore wind power plans.
There's still a lot of real interest in continuing these projects, but it's simply impossible at this moment in time.
Adrian Downey is with Power Advisory, a consulting firm that's worked with the Nova Scotia government. The Trump administration paused some wind power construction, erased wind energy areas in the Gulf of Maine, and put existing permits under review. Downey says the industry is feeling burned, and plans to secure abundant power for Maine and New England are in jeopardy. The region's electric grid operator projects demand will jump 11% in the next decade.
If we can't build it here and we can't build enough capacity through other resources fast enough, is that a potential opportunity for the Northeast to tap into? We'll see.
But Grant Provost, business officer for the Iron Workers Union in Maine, sees opportunities. He says U.S. workers are already employed by global companies likely to help build Nova Scotia's wind farms. And they've got experience and union connections across the border.
You know, the possibility of U.S. workers who already have the skills and the certifications that are needed for offshore wind going to Canada to supplement their marketplace while they stand it up is high.
Nova Scotia plans to offer the first leases for 5 gigawatts of power early next year. And if it's designated a project of national interest by the Canadian government, financial incentives and streamlined permitting will be included.
That would be a very big win for the industry.
Alisa Oberman heads up trade group Marine Renewables Canada, which has seen an increase in members from the U.S. And Oberman says attendance at its annual conference this week is nearly double what it was last year.
You know, there's that possibility that investors will be looking to Nova Scotia or Canada because there is a real opportunity starting to develop there.
The Nova Scotia government declined to be interviewed for this story. But in a statement, it says that due to policy uncertainty in the U.S., developers, supply chain companies, and investors are looking for a stable jurisdiction the province can provide. And the government says capital allocated to offshore wind on the U.S. Eastern Seaboard, quote, now needs a home, and we see opportunity for it to be invested in Nova Scotia. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Peter McGuire.
The federal spending bill signed into law this week will effectively ban all hemp-derived consumer products containing the psychoactive ingredient THC. Public health officials applaud the new law, but critics say it will kneecap the hemp industry. Michael Livingston reports.
Hemp is the part of the cannabis plant that was federally legalized for industrial uses in 2018. But the law didn't clearly define how much THC could be in products such as gummies, drinks, and vapes. Public health officials say these products mirror the effects of marijuana, but are not subject to the same regulations. Patty Locarotolo-Hymanson is a physician and former Maine lawmaker. She says the regulations will help save lives, but acknowledges that it could hurt some small businesses.
I would weigh the scale in favor of the public health benefits, for sure. But I have to speak, you know, for the industry, many of whom I met, who I know will be hurt by this.
Hemp industry leaders say Congress should have enacted federal standards rather than a ban. The law will officially be in effect next year. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Michael Livingston.
The Standish Hannaford received a swatting call this morning claiming an active shooter was in the store, according to the Cumberland County Sheriff's Office. Shortly after 11 a.m., a 911 call to Cumberland County's Communication Center came from inside the store. Deputies arrived and determined that there was no active shooter and the call was a hoax. They arrested 18-year-old Pather Joyce and charged him with making a false public alarm or report. And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Join us tomorrow morning at 8 for Weekend Edition on Maine Public Radio. I'm Ari Snyder. Thanks for listening.